An Innkeeper Christmas. Welcome. We have another look into the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot, who called us to live to a higher standard, to not be satisfied with just a little empty religion in life as a shallow substitute of what God wants us to have. As our series continues in the coming weeks, we'll hear from family, friends, and others who were influenced by the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot. Welcome. As we think about the anniversary of sorts of when we started around this time in 2021. Thanks, whether you've been here the whole time or just getting started on our journey with us. Welcome. Well, here on the Elizabeth Elliot Gateway to Joy broadcast, we consider a couple more Christmas stories, one about Christmas in prison, and an imaginative story of what the innkeeper may have been thinking. We'll be hearing from Elizabeth's brother, Jim Howard, as he talks about a Christmas story related to Jim Elliot. Back when Jim Howard was just 7 years old. And speaking of youngsters, we'll be hearing from Valerie Elliot Shepherd, Elizabeth's daughter. As a four-year-old at Christmas time, she was talking about things in her life. Right now, though, we hear about the innkeeper. It's an imagining of the story of the man who kept the place where Joseph and Mary were not allowed to stay. Maybe you've sung the song about No Room at the Inn. Hear about a dog named Noah and more. Let's imagine. Here's Elizabeth Elliot.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend, Elizabeth Elliot, reading a thin little book that just came out, I believe, last Christmas, by John Piper. It's his imagining the innkeeper who kept the inn where Joseph and Mary arrived when she was about to give birth to her child. Jake's wife would have been 58 the day that Jesus passed the gate of Bethlehem and slowly walked toward Jacob's inn. The people talked with friends, and children played along the paths, and Jesus hummed a song and smiled at every child he saw. He paused with one small lass to draw a camel in the dirt, then said, "What's this?" The girl bent down her head to study what the Lord had made. She smiled, "A camel, sir," and laid her finger on the bulging back where merchants bind their leather pack. "It's got a hump." "Indeed it does. And who do you believe it was who made this camel with his hump?" Without a thought that this would stump the rabbi guild and be reviled, she said, "God did." And Jesus smiled. "Good eyes, my child. And would that all Jerusalem within that wall of yonder stone could see the signs of peace." He left the lass with lines of simple wonder in her face, and slowly went to find the place where he was born. Folks said the inn had never been a place for sin, for Jacob was a holy man. Jacob is the innkeeper. And he and Rachel had a plan to marry, have a child or two, and serve the folks who traveled through, especially the poor who brought their meal and turtle doves and sought a place to stay near Zion's gate. They'd rise up early, stay up late to help the pilgrims go and come. And when the place was full, to some, especially the poorest, they would say, "We're sorry, there's no room. But stay now, if you like, out back. There's lots of hay, and we have extra cots that you can use. There'll be no charge. The stable isn't very large. But Noah, that's the dog, keeps it safe." He was a wedding gift to Jake because the shepherds knew he loved the dog. "There's nothing in the Decalogue," he used to joke, "that says a man can't love a dog." The children ran ahead of Jesus as he strode toward Jacob's inn. The stony road that led up to the inn was deep with centuries of wear and steep at one point just before the door. The Lord knocked once, then twice, before he heard an old man's voice, "Round back," it called. So Jesus took the track that led around the inn. The old man leaned back in his chair and told the dog to never mind. "Ain't had no one to tend the door, my lad, for 30 years. I'm sorry for the inconvenience to your sore feet. The road to Jerusalem is hard, ain't it? Don't mind old Shem. He's harmless like his dad. Won't bite a Roman soldier in the night. Sit down." And Jacob waved the stump of his right arm. "We're in a slump right now. Got lots of time to think and talk. Come sit and have a drink from Jacob's well," he laughed. "You own the inn?" the Lord required. "On loan, you'd better say. God owns the inn." At that, the Lord knew they were kin and ventured on. "Do you recall the tax when Caesar said to all the world that each must be enrolled?" Old Jacob winced. "Are north winds cold? Are deserts dry? Do fishes swim and ravens fly? I do. A grim and awful year it was for me when God ordained that strange decree. How could I such a time forget? Why do you ask?" "I have a debt to pay, and I must see how much. Why do you say that it was such a grim and awful year?" He raised the stump of his right arm. "So dazed, young man, I didn't know I'd lost my arm. Do you know what it cost for me to house the Son of God?" The old man took his cedar rod and swept it round the place. "Empty, for 30 years alone, you see? Old Jacob, poor old Jacob, runs it with one arm, a dog, no sons. But I had sons, once. Joseph was my firstborn. He was small because his mother was so sick. When he turned 3, the Lord was good to me, and Rachel and our baby Ben was born, the very fortnight when the blessed family arrived. And Rachel's gracious heart contrived a way for them to stay there in that very stall." The man was thin and tired. "You look a lot like him." But Jesus said, "Why was it grim? We got a reputation here that night, nothing at all to fear in that, we thought. It was of God. But in 1 year, the slaughter squad from Herod came. Where do you suppose they started?" "Not a clue." We didn't have a clue what they had come to do. No time to pray, no time to run, no time to get poor Joseph off the street and let him say goodbye to Ben, or me, or Rachel. Only time to see a lifted spear smash through his spine and chest. He stumbled to the sign that welcomed strangers to the place, and looked with panic at my face, as if to ask what he had done. "Young man, you ever lost a son?" The tears streamed down the Savior's cheek. He shook his head, but couldn't speak. Before I found the breath to scream, I heard the words, "A horrid dream. Kill every child who's 2 or less. Spare not for aught, nor make excess. Let this one be the oldest here, and if you count your own life dear, let none escape." I had no sword, no weapons in my house. But, Lord, I had my hands, and I would save the son of my right hand. So brave, old Rachel was so brave. Her hands were like 1,000 iron bands around the boy. She wouldn't let him go. And so her own back met with every thrust and blow. I lost my arm, my wife, my sons. The cost for housing the Messiah here. Why would he simply disappear and never come to help? They sat in silence. Jacob wondered at the stranger's tears. "I am the boy that Herod wanted to destroy. You gave my parents room to give me life. And then God let me live and took your wife. Ask me not why the one should live, another die. God's ways are high, and you will know in time. But I have come to show you what the Lord prepared the night you made a place for heaven's light. In 2 weeks, they will crucify my flesh. But mark this, Jacob. I will rise in 3 days from the dead and place my foot upon the head of him who has the power of death. And I will raise with life and breath your wife and Ben and Joseph too, and give them back, Jacob, back to you with everything the world can store, and you will reign forevermore. That's an imaginative story written by John Piper. John Piper has a vivid imagination, hasn't he? But I was overwhelmed when I came across this thin little volume. What an imagination. It could be true, you know. Jesus, on his way to crucifixion, might have stopped by in Bethlehem. He might have come upon the very place where Mary had given him birth. It might have been that the old innkeeper was still alive, and they had this conversation. What a marvelous, glorious ending. Jesus says to the innkeeper, in 2 weeks they will crucify my flesh, but mark this, Joseph, I will rise in 3 days from the dead and place my foot upon the head of him who has the power of death. And I will raise with life and breath your wife and Ben and Joseph too, and give them back, Jacob, to you, with everything the world can store, and you will reign forevermore. And the Bible tells us that those of us who love him are going to reign with him. Merry Christmas.
Yes, an imaginative tale, the story of the innkeeper. You know, one of the things about this time of the year is that we are reminded of memories from when we were very young. We'll be hearing from a very young Valerie Elliott Shepherd when she was just 4 years old around Christmas time. Right now, though, let's hear from Elizabeth's brother, Jim Howard, as he talks about Jim Elliott.
How well did you know Jim?
He and my brother David were classmates in college. They were both on the wrestling team together. They were very close friends all through their years, in those years. David invited Jim to come to our home in New Jersey. Jim's home was in Portland, Oregon, but he did come. He came at Christmas time, which would have been Christmas of 1947, I believe. I was 7 years old at the time, so my recollections were from early childhood. And Jim seemed like a big brother in the family to me. He was big and strong, like my brothers were. So I admired him as I admired them. On Christmas morning, I stepped on one of my Christmas gifts that I had just opened. It was a very small horse and buggy made in England, made out of metal, and I was very pleased to get it at Christmas. And I stepped on it and bent something out of shape. And Jim said to me, while I was weeping over my loss, bring it here and we'll fix that for you. So he did, fixed my little horse and buggy. And, of course, my estimate of him went up at that point because I was cheered up. Sometime later, I was in junior high school, and I had to make a banner for my class, and it needed to include a five-pointed star. Well, I didn't know how to do that geometrically, but Jim was visiting in our home, and he said, well, I'll help you with that. So he spread the job out on the dining room table and did it in no time flat and made it very geometrically correct. So, again, a happy memory.
Jim Howard, brother of Elizabeth Elliott. Later on, we'll hear from a 4-year-old Valerie Elliott Shepherd But right now, let's go back to our Gateway to Joy programs, the second for today. What would it be like to spend Christmas in prison? Is there a certain freedom you can enjoy, even in a place like that? We go back to a Nazi prison, of all things, back to the 1940s. Celebration with decorations stripped away. Inmates and perhaps workers remembering Christmases in the past. Is there hope? Is there light in such a dark place? Consider a true story.
This is your friend, Elizabeth Elliott, and I have a wonderful story about Christmas in prison by Hans Lilje. It sometimes seems that the traditions that have grown up around Christmas almost choke out its essence. This true story tells of a celebration stripped of all the outward trappings. Despite its unlikely setting, a Nazi prison in 1944, it illuminates the real meaning of Christmas, the coming of a new light into the darkness of our world. Christmas was near. Christmas Eve in prison is so terrible because a wave of sentimentality passes through the gloomy building. Everyone thinks of his own loved ones for whom he is longing. Everyone suffers because he doesn't know how they will be celebrating the festival of divine and human love. Recollections of childhood come surging back, almost overwhelming some, especially those who are condemned to death, who cannot help looking back at their past lives. It is no accident that in prison suicide attempts are particularly numerous on this special day. In our case, however, the most remarkable thing was the sentimental softness which came over the guards. Most of these SS men were young fellows who were usually unnecessarily brutal in their behavior. But when Christmas Eve came, we hardly knew them. The spirit of this evening made such a deep impression upon them. At this time, we had a commandant who was human. Although he had risen from the lower ranks to be an SS officer, he had remained an honest man, who, although he was harsh, was not brutal, and who often granted us certain facilities until, on account of his humane attitude, he was removed from his post. Essentially, he made more impression on us than his successor, who, in many respects, was also a decent man. On this particular evening in the year, this commandant had made various kind and humane actions possible. For instance, among us there was one who was condemned to death and was already chained. The commandant had his chains removed, and his violin was given back to him. This man was a great artist, and his playing was like magic. Presently, the great vaulted hall resounded with the beautiful strains of his violin. As evening fell, I was walking up and down my cell, looking at a nativity scene which one of my children had made for me. Illuminated by a candle and decorated with some fir branches, it made my cell look like Christmas. Meanwhile, I was thinking about the Christmas Eve service which I had conducted a year before in our church in Lichterfeld. It had been a memorable Christmas, a Christmas festival almost entirely without children, for most families had sent their children away from the city since it was increasingly exposed to air raids. So the men who were left were chiefly men detained in Berlin by their war duties, or else they were older people, many of them solitary, who were rather indifferent to the dangers of air raids and did not need to take care of themselves for the sake of other people. In any case, it was a remarkable congregation which gathered in the damaged, ice-cold church for the service on Christmas Eve. As I recalled the service, I remembered that I had preached on the words from the prophet Isaiah. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. At the beginning of my sermon, I had pointed out that when we were children, we used to dawdle home after the Christmas service because we wanted to look in everybody's windows to see them lighting up their Christmas trees, until at last we reached our home and stood spellbound before our own dazzling tree. This year, however, all the windows were darkened, and the whole world was blacked out. Then I said, "This year, we older people, men separated from their families, solitary people, old people, must learn to celebrate Christmas apart from all childish romanticism and all sentimentality. For this year, there is no room for this sort of thing. Then, with the help of this prophetic saying, I tried to make clear the real meaning of the Christmas message for ourselves, grown-up people, passing through a dark and difficult time. I had just reached this point in my reflections, and had just begun to feel a painful longing for a congregation to whom I might preach the Christmas gospel on this very evening, at this hard and difficult time, when suddenly, outside my door, I heard my number called. Usually, when this call resounded through the wing of our prison, it didn't mean anything good. Too often, it meant interrogations or ill treatment, removal from the prison, or still worse. Although I was prepared for anything, I really couldn't imagine that they would do something terrible to me. I rose and followed the guard who led me downstairs from my cell in the third story. I was taken directly to the commandant. In accordance with his usual custom, he did not speak but went on ahead to another cell. Before he entered this cell, he turned to the guard and said, "Bring number 212 to this cell, too." When the heavy cell door was opened, a man rose to meet us. At once I saw in him a striking family likeness and recognized that he was Count X. His brother, one of the first to be condemned after the 20th of July, had asked, just before his execution, that I might be allowed to give him the sacrament, a request that was naturally refused. He had been one of the most frequent attenders at my service, and on the Sunday before his arrest he had joined in divine worship and had received Holy Communion. Quite spontaneously, forgetting where I was, I mentioned this recollection to X, but the commandant interrupted me harshly, saying, "I have not brought you gentlemen together for personal conversation." Then he added, turning to the count, "You asked that a certain clergyman, your own friend, might be allowed to visit you this evening in a pastoral capacity. Unfortunately, I have not been able to accede to this request, but here is Dr. Lillier, who will address some words to you." Now I saw what was expected of me. The count replied, "What I really want, sir, is to make my confession, and then to receive Holy Communion." Immediately I said that I was ready to do what was required, and the commandant seemed to have no objections. So a small silver cup was brought. In the meantime, number 212 had also been brought into the cell. He was the violinist who was under sentence of death. The guard was sent out of the cell, so we four men were there together. At the commandant's suggestion, the violinist played a Christmas chorale exquisitely. Then I read the gospel for the Christmas day from Luke 2. The violinist played another Christmas chorale, and in the meantime I had been able to arrange my thoughts a little about the passage in Isaiah which had filled my mind when I was summoned downstairs. I said, "This evening we are a congregation, part of the Church of Christ, and this great word of divine promise is as true for us today as it was for those of a year ago, among whom at that time was your own brother, and for all who this year receive it in faith. Our chief concern now," I said, "is to receive this promise in firm faith, and to believe that God, through Jesus Christ, has allowed the eternal light to arise and shine upon this world, which is plunged in the darkness of death, and that he will also make this light to shine for us. At this moment, in our cells, we have practically nothing that makes the Christmas festival so familiar and so lovely. But there is one thing left to us, God's great promise. Let us cling to this in the midst of the darkness. Here and now, in the midst of the uncertainty of our prison life, in the shadow of death, we will praise him by a firm and unshaken faith in his word, which is addressed to us." Then in the midst of the cell, the count knelt down upon the hard stone floor. And while I prayed aloud the beautiful old prayer of confession from Thomas à Kempis, which he himself had chosen, and then pronounced absolution, the tears were running silently down his cheeks. It was a very quiet celebration of the sacrament, full of deep confidence in God. Almost palpably, the wings of divine mercy hovered over us as we knelt at the altar in a prison cell on Christmas Eve. We were prisoners in the power of the Gestapo in Berlin. But the peace of God enfolded us. It was real and present, like a hand laid gently upon us. Since the commandant had obviously done all this without permission and on his own personal responsibility, he could not allow any further conversation. The violinist played. I parted from my fellow prisoner, saying, God bless you, Brother X. When we reached the corridor, the commandant shook my hand twice with an iron grip. Thank you, he said. You cannot imagine what you have done for me this evening in my sad and difficult daily work. I was taken back to my cell, but I praised God and praised him from my whole heart that in this building, under the shadow of death, and in the face of so much trouble and distress, a Christian group had assembled to celebrate Christmas. For it is possible to have every external sign of festivity and comfort and joyful celebrations, yet not to have a true Christmas congregation, while in the shadow of death and in much trouble of heart, a real congregation can gather at Christmas. Upon us shines the eternal light, filling the world with radiance bright. Shortly after Christmas, Count X was sent to a concentration camp. The violinist was killed by the Gestapo during the last days before the collapse. I have completely lost sight of the commandant, who soon after this was removed from his post because he had proved too humane. But the memory of my Christmas service in 1944, illuminated by the consoling and eternal light of God, still remains with me.
Christmas in prison. You know, we've been thinking about memories, whether it's in a Nazi prison or Jim Howard and his memories of when he was 7. Well, Valerie Elliott Shepherd, the only child of Jim and Elizabeth, was just 4 years old when she was placed in front of a microphone to talk about her young life.
Around Christmas of 1958, little 4-year-old Valerie Elliott came out of the tribe to be with Mary Lou McCulley and Marge Saint in Quito for the holidays. Little Valerie was interviewed on one of the programs in the HCJB studios, and we listen to her now.
Where is it?
Where is your mother right now, Valerie?
Kurai.
Yes, and who's over there in the Kurai? Who is she with?
She's not with Dayuma.
No, she's not with Dayuma. Dayuma's up here in Quito. Who is your mommy with?
Some alcohol.
What did Jesus do on the cross, Valerie?
Died.
What do you want to be when you're a great big girl, Valerie?
Just going to be a mommy.
A little 4-year-old Valerie Elliott Shepherd. This is taken from the Alka Story, an album from that was produced by Nancy Wolnow. Our thanks to Nancy and others who worked on this, and that we were able to once again take part of that and share it with you. But our time of sharing is just about at an end. Let me remind you, though, if you want more, whether it's a devotional, a video, Gateway to Joy program, other resources, go to elizabethelliott.org. elizabethelliott.org. Thanks for letting us come along with you today. On behalf of the Elizabeth Elliott Foundation, in cooperation with the Bible Broadcasting Network, thanks for joining us again today. That's elizabethelliott.org for more information. And if you get a chance, leave a review for us wherever you found this program today. Thanks. Well, until next time, may God remind you each and every day, you are loved with an everlasting love. And Christmas time, or any time of the year, underneath are God's everlasting arms.